peace. This is Atan Thomas, and you're listening to WPFW Washington, your station for jazz and justice.
And welcome to Community Watch and Comment for Tuesday, November 11th. I'm Dave Raven. It's good to be with you all in these precarious times. And we have a, I think, an important and good show for you. Later in the show, towards the end of the show, the Post Classical Ensemble has an interesting program coming up on November 19th at the Kennedy Center, The Pale Blue Dot, a musical voyage inspired by nature. The program explores the path from wild, pristine nature to a degraded natural world impacted by climate change to the rebirth of nature and cause for celebration. We'll be joined by the Post Classical Ensemble's musical director, Angel Il Ordonez. But first, the possible end to the shutdown is all the news. But no matter what happens in that regard, the military has an increasing presence in our lives, including attacks on boats in the Caribbean and in the Pacific, threats against Venezuela and Nigeria, increasing presence of the military in our cities, and what it portends for next year's election, the soaring military budget, on and on. And joining us to talk about all this and more is Bill Astori, a retired Air Force Lieutenant Colonel, history professor, and writer. His blog on Substack is Bracing Views. He's a senior fellow at the Eisenhower Media Network. Thank you, Mr. Astori, for joining us. It's great having you.
Thanks. Thanks for having me, Dave.
And let's talk about we're on at 11-11-11. It's November 11th at 11 o'clock. Talk about the irony and the significance of that to your history professor, if you could touch on that.
Yeah, no, that's great timing. The Armistice Day, originally Veterans Day was Armistice Day, which marked the end of World War One, and that came at the 11th hour on the 11th day in the 11th month of 1918. So Armistice Day was really a celebration of peace finally being restored to Europe after more than 4 years of devastating war in World War One, and fortunately for the United States, we were only involved in that war for about a year or so, and even then, we lost over 100,000 men in that ghastly war. So Armistice Day was all about peace. Some of your listeners may recall that President Woodrow Wilson back then hoped that with the Treaty of Versailles and the creation of the League of Nations, that we would have a sort of eternal peace. But obviously that didn't happen. 20 years later, we had World War II. And ever since then, it seems the United States has been more or less in a state of permanent warfare.
I mean, World War One was supposed to be the war to end all wars.
That's right.
And didn't quite turn out that way. So you're a retired Lieutenant Colonel. Talk about your, I have a feeling there's a certain transition that happened in your life. Just talk about your service and what transpired after that.
Right. Well, I served for 20 years in the Air Force. I come from a family of firefighters and police officers as well in my family. So I guess we believe in public service. But I surprised myself. I started out as a mechanical engineer. I did not think I was going to serve for 20 years, but I did. After I retired in 2005, I became a history professor in Pennsylvania. I did that for about another 10 years. And then I became more or less a writer for sites like TomDispatch.com and my own blog, Bracing Views. I think it was in 2007 that I wrote my first article for Tom Dispatch, where I came out, you know, very strongly against the Iraq War, what President Bush and Dick Cheney were up to and trying to hide behind the bemedaled chest of David Petraeus. And ever since then, I've been writing, I guess you'd say, fairly critical articles about America's military-industrial complex and the militarization of our society.
It's really interesting. I mean, so did you actually serve in Iraq in the invasion? I remember I was editing at New York at National Public Radio, and I had to edit my newscaster who said that it was an incursion into Iraq. I said, no, it's an invasion. were you actually involved in that invasion or what?
We're always coming up with good Orwellian terms, right?
Yep.
So an invasion is described as an incursion. And then, of course, Vladimir Putin copied us, because instead of talking about invading Ukraine, he called it the special military operation. I was not in Iraq. I didn't serve in the Iraq War. I was actually at the Defense Language Institute in Monterey, California at that time. And my job, as well as the other people there, was trying to train up as quickly as possible more troops who would actually be able to speak Arabic and other languages, so that they could rely more on language rather than on force. But unfortunately, you know, most of our troops did not speak Arabic, and they spoke mainly with bullets and rifle butts and hellfire missiles.
Yep. I mean, the adage, I think, is true. When you have a hammer, everything looks like a nail.
And we have a very big hammer.
We have a very big hammer.
A sledgehammer, yeah.
Okay, this is Community Watch and Comment, and I think I failed to give out the number. We really would love to hear from folks. 202-588-0893. This, I think, is a very important subject we have today, and we have a wonderful guest who would love to hear your questions, your comments. 202-588-0893. Community Watch and Comment. We'd love to have your comments. I had it towards the end of my interview, and I shoved it up to the top because I think it's the overarching question. Our defense budget, our so-called defense budget. I guess Trump wants to call it Department of War, and I think actually that's a fair label. As that was the name for the department until after World War II. It is a Department of War. In fact, it's not always about defense. I mean, we, you know, in so many instances, that some of which we're going to talk about, you know, we're not defending nothing. We're a Department of War. We're talking about a proposed budget of over $1 trillion, and then that's not nothing. That's right up there with Elon Musk's new salary. If he meets all his markers, I mean, $1 trillion, what is it? It's $1,000 billion. If you could talk about our war budget, our defense budget.
Right. No, I agree. Department of War is an example of truth in advertising, because, you know, we've been at war as a country ever since 9/11, if not before then, obviously. I think what worries me is, when you stop and think about it, if you're, say, a teenager, or you're in your early 20s in the United States, you've never known a time when this country wasn't at war. And I think this is very disturbing, because, again, when you think back to the original Armistice Day, which became Veterans Day, you know, we, as a country, thought about and use the word peace. So, for example, at my desk here, I have two peace silver dollars from the early 1920s that my father had that he passed on to me. And those peace silver dollars were meant to commemorate the end of World War One and the fact that we looked ahead to a time of peace. But now we have an imperial war budget, Dave, as you point out. It's about $1 trillion. And this is an absurd amount of money. But when you stop to think about it, the size of our War Department is so huge. We have in the neighborhood of 750 military bases around the world. Our country
is... Could you repeat that? People don't realize this.
Right.
750 military bases around the world.
Right. And that doesn't include the bases here in the United States. So we are very much on a permanent wartime configuration. And added to that is just this idea of what they call full spectrum dominance, meaning that the United States must dominate everything. We must be the strongest country in the land, the sea, the air, in space as well. And of course, added to that is cyberspace and AI, artificial intelligence. So whatever realm of conflict there might be, the United States insists on being the most powerful. And that is obviously comes at a tremendous price. Not just in dollars, but in the militarization of our society, and also the fact that opportunity cost, you know, $1 trillion we spend on war is $1 trillion we can't spend on beautifying and making America a better country, a healthcare, education, what have you.
Or maybe feeding people. Yeah. I mean, we would be remiss to not mention that the military got paid, during this shutdown. I think donor Mellon, took care of the, 130 million to get our military through the shutdown. But he very interestingly did not donate that for SNAP.
Right.
For food stamps. So we talk about the military industrial complex. That's a term from Eisenhower, which your organization is named after. I mean, talk about Eisenhower's farewell speech, and I think he wanted it called the military-industrial congressional complex, and his aides got him to drop the congressional, I believe. What would he make of what's going on right now?
Yeah, I think Eisenhower would be more than upset at the path our country has taken since his warning in 1961. Of course, you know, we all know Eisenhower led the Normandy invasion in 1944 in France. Eisenhower was obviously a great believer in the military, but Eisenhower also saw the ugly face of war. And so in his famous farewell address in 1961, he warned our country against the growing power of this military industrial complex, to which, as you said, Dave, he added Congress, although he took it out of the speech. And he said that we need to be an alert and knowledgeable citizenry because this immense construct of the military-industrial complex posed a dire threat to democracy in America. And ever since then, ever since those words, that now were 64 years ago, that military-industrial complex has only grown more powerful and more of a threat to what remains of democracy here in our country.
Yeah. I mean, it's very serious. And this is a military man. This is not a pacifist. This is a this is a man that understood that at times you do need to use the military. World War II being one example, although, you know, one can obviously or possibly question that, but I mean, this is not a pacifist, but I think he said something like, you know, God forbid there's someone sitting in the Oval Office that doesn't understand the imperative of these weapons makers to push various products, various weapons on us, and it certainly has happened. I should say I'm talking to Bill Astori, a retired Air Force Lieutenant Colonel, history professor and writer, and we would love to hear from folks. 202-588-0893. It's Community Watch and Comment, and we need your questions, your comments for our wonderful guest here. Let's get the industrial complex down to something concrete or something watery, I guess you could say, namely the Caribbean. And it's also the Pacific. We've killed, over 75 people so far, allegedly for drug running, although there's been no evidence presented of that. I was inquiring with a friend, how do we know how many people we've killed? I guess there's infrared. You can tell how many people are on the boat, but we don't, you know, no one. Normally, you've got the Coast Guard interdicting boats like this and supplying evidence and maybe arresting some folks, but now we're just blowing them out of the water. Your thoughts?
Right. Well, it's illegal. It's murderously illegal. And as I say, it's, what do they say? It's worse than a crime. It's a mistake. And in the sense that if you're going to wage a war, let's assume that, you know, that everyone on these boats really is guilty of drug running, right? Well, I mean, what you'd like to do ideally is interdict. You'd like to, you know, stop the boats, search them, and then interrogate these people to find out, you know, where the drugs are coming from. This is how you, I don't know if it's, you know, we've been fighting a drug war forever and the drugs are winning, so to speak. But nevertheless, if we really want to stop or at least slow down this influx of drugs in our country, the Trumpian approach of simply blowing boats out of the water is a stupid way of doing that. It's counterproductive. And of course it's obviously illegal as well, because I mean, we don't know, so many times in so many wars, our intelligence has proven to be faulty. And so here we are basically blowing up boats and killing people based on intelligence that may well prove to be faulty.
Right. And we don't necessarily know that it's even based on intelligence. It just looks, you know, we've got great video blowing these, you know, criminals out of the water, and we don't even know the basis for how they're operating, in part because Congress is abdicating its role as the entity that's supposed to be declaring war, and there's no declaration. We created a War Powers Act coming out of the debacle of Vietnam, where we're supposed to have Congress sign off on this kind of thing, and Congress is doing nothing of the kind. The House hasn't been in session since September.
Right. No, it's an example of vigilante justice. And I don't know how many listeners are Clint Eastwood fans like I am, but I remember the Clint Eastwood movie Magnum Force, in which even the Dirty Harry character played by Clint Eastwood is against this rogue police force, which is going out and you know, killing criminals, and sometimes not criminals. This is the problem with vigilante justice, is so many times you end up killing people who are innocent. I mean, this is a country. In theory, we have a constitution. This is a country where we are supposed to be based on, we're supposed to be obedient to the rule of law. And in this case, we're disobeying our own laws. And this is something that, it's again, it's another further militarization of our society and a hardening of our hearts as well.
Yeah, I mean, I'm old enough to remember the Vietnam War, and you had people in Congress speaking up. You had William Fulbright holding hearings. You had some attempt at some kind of counterweight to the power of the presidency, and it's not happening now. I mean, it's quite frightening. If you could touch on our motivations here, it seems to me it's multi-layered. You've got a Secretary of State, a Cuban-American who has it in for Cuba, and apparently some believe that this is the first step go after the lefty president of Venezuela, Maduro, and then the next step is going after Cuba. If you could touch on our motivations here.
Yeah, no, I think that's plausible. Rubio is definitely involved. But ultimately, I think the prize is Venezuela's oil and natural gas, as well as other resources that they have. So, I mean, Venezuela has the world's largest proven oil reserves. And Trump has said quite plainly that he wants that oil, that he is, you know, more than happy to see Maduro overthrown so that American companies can come in and exploit that huge oil reserve that Venezuela has. So I think ultimately, I mean, certainly, you know, part of this is Rubio, but this is a long-term plan, and Venezuela's oil has always been the prize.
Yeah. It's daunting. And of course, you know, some would say, hey, this is a great way, a lot of noise and smoke and mirrors to avoid talking about Jeffrey Epstein. I mean, this probably would be happening regardless, but boy, it sure is convenient. We're this show is not about Jeffrey Epstein. It's about a military industrial congressional complex. If you could touch on that, I mean, we're speculating, but boy, it sure seemed to be a blinking red light.
Yeah, yeah. No, I've read about the Epstein case, and I've read about the accusations, some of which are against President Trump. And if any of them are true, it's certainly a horrible thing. This whole Epstein affair, the exploitation of young women, and in some cases underage, basically girls, and the way that this has been covered up by our government is particularly disgraceful.
Yeah, I mean, we'll see what happens. The House, I guess, is coming back into session, and they've got a new member. If she ever gets sworn in, and that will be tipping the scales to open up the investigation congressionally, so we will stay tuned. I should say I'm speaking with Bill Astori, retired Air Force Lieutenant Colonel, history professor and writer, and he's a senior fellow at the Eisenhower Media Network. And we'd love to hear, as I've been saying, from folks, 202-588-0893. Please chime in. Trump has made a threat to Nigeria. It's kind of an expression, it seems to me, of the Christian nationalism that is the underbelly of this administration. Trump is saying Christians are being threatened in Nigeria. If you could touch on that.
Right. No, that seems to be exactly the case, where this is the threats against Nigeria, which are particularly unhinged by Trump. They seem to be an attempt by him to play to his base. And when you think about it, basically what Trump is implying in his comments about Nigeria is is another crusade. He's basically saying that Nigeria is threatening Christians in that country, and that he is going to be the protector of Christianity. Now this is a man who was once asked what would be his what was his favorite Bible passage, and he could not come up with one. So Trump is kidding. No, yeah, he was asked. Of course, the other thing Trump, I was raised Roman Catholic, so it's strange indeed. I know Trump also has his own version of the Bible, which includes the Declaration of Independence. I think he was selling those for about $60 a pop.
I think that they were printed up in China, right?
I think they were. I think they were. So, yeah. But the president's rhetoric, where on the one hand, this is sort of what is scary about Trump. He's so unpredictable. He's like a weather vane in a tornado. I mean, he just on the one time. He's talking about, I want to be a peace president. He wants to win the Nobel Peace Prize and so on. And then the very next minute, he's threatening Nigeria and Venezuela and whatever other country, pops into his head that poses some sort of a risk or is some kind of an opportunity for him to stir up and appease his base.
I mean, it's really... It's pretty embarrassing. I think some reporter asked him, well, aren't you obligated to support and defend the Constitution? And his answer was, I don't know. I would need to talk to my lawyers about that. Right. I mean, this is the oath that he took when he's sworn in to be the president of the United States, and he doesn't know whether he needs to uphold the Constitution. I mean, it's I think he described the Declaration of Independence as a statement of love and brotherhood. And right. he had, and the reporter was looking at, he has a copy of the Declaration framed in his office, and he doesn't, it's a statement of rebellion, sir. I mean, it's not a statement of love.
Yeah, no, I remember speaking of the Declaration of Independence, that's exactly right, because the men who affixed their signatures to the Declaration knew that they were doing something very risky, that in rebelling against the king of England, King of Britain, that they were basically, from the British perspective, they were treasonous and could hang yep. as a result. Oh, yeah. So not exactly.
They would hang. We would either hang separately or hang together, or whatever Franklin said. No, yeah. It was. I think Franklin was concerned about going overseas to France because if he got caught, he would be hung by the British.
Right.
I mean, a very risky venture is not an expression of love. I mean, we have a president that somehow got through college. It's extraordinary, and President Trump, if you're listening, I just have four words for you. Turn up the volume, and call in and defend yourself if you so choose. I mean, it's embarrassing. I mean, I go to Europe and I find myself apologizing. We were in Denmark, and I'm apologizing to the Danes for. Are threatening Greenland with the territory of Denmark, and the woman at the airport looked at me and said, "Well, I appreciate that."
right. I guess Trump sees Greenland as sort of like a hostile real estate grab, right? Something that something that he'd do in New York City.
Yep. So what do you think, it's been a few weeks now, but what do you think about this convocation of, over 800 top generals and admirals at Quantico, a few weeks ago. I mean, it's comical, except it's quite serious. And if you could touch on that.
Right. No, it is. It is. I guess you know, I agree with you. On the one hand, you could sort of laugh at it. But on the other hand, it was quite serious, because here you have the self-styled Secretary of War, Pete Hegseth, you know, calling all the generals and admirals together. And then instead of talking about something that's important, perhaps, he was mainly dressing them down, talking about the need for example, being physically fit and not being, fat generals are our biggest problem. And then just the whole, pushing the idea of the warrior ethos. Well, this is something the military has been pushing for 25 years. And it's also something that I find disturbing, because that's not what U.S. military is supposed to be about. I mean, when I joined the military, we had the ethos of the citizen soldier. Of course, I was an airman, so it was a citizen airman, with the emphasis on citizen coming first. We're not supposed to be, our military members, our veterans, they're not supposed to be warriors who exist just for war and to fight wars. They're supposed to be, citizens who have signed, who have taken the oath of office to defend our country. And we respect them for that reason, for their service, not because they're unthinking warriors who go around the globe waging wars of choice, led by people like Hegseth and Trump.
Yeah, I mean, it's, and then Trump, Trump is apparently a little bit unnerved because the generals are and the admirals are following up the tradition of not being politicized. They're not going to rally, and their oath is to the Constitution, not to the presidency. There wasn't, a lot of applause, if any, for Trump. And then he turns around and goes to a military base, I think the very next day, and is politicizing his speech, attacking Biden, making it a political undertaking instead of, support for the troops, certainly, but he takes it to the next level.
Yeah, it's very disturbing, because Trump has never really understood what he's never really understood his job. He has no idea, I think, of what public service really means. I remember in March of 2016, during one of the debates when he was first running for president, they asked him about his orders, where he would have, he had this idea that the troops should just go out and kill terrorists, just like they're doing now, so-called terrorists, but here there are drug runners in the Caribbean. And and Trump said at the time, he said, well, they're going to follow my orders. The troops will follow my orders, irrespective of their legality. And I wrote an article where it's basically, this is fundamentally wrong. And I wrote in March of 2016 that Trump had basically disqualified himself from the presidency. Of course, turned out I was wrong, and maybe Trump was right, in the sense that, not enough people realize that what Trump is doing is fundamentally against our system of government.
Yeah. I think at one point he has said, why can't I have generals like Hitler had? I mean, to actually vocalize that, I think there's one account by an author of one of his Trump's bios that the book by his bedside was speeches by Adolf Hitler.
Well, he should be careful. He should be careful what he wishes for, because don't forget the German generals did get together in 1944, at least some of them did, and tried to kill Hitler and came very close to succeeding.
Right. Exactly, maybe, but just to not be embarrassed to vocalize something like that, it's dangerous, it's scary, and it's embarrassing. I mean, this is our president. I should say I'm talking to Bill Astori, retired Air Force Lieutenant Colonel, history professor, writer. He's got a column in Substack of Bracing Views. We'd love to hear from folks, 202-588-0893. If you could touch on the dismissal and the and whatnot of top military brass. I think the head of Southern Command, South Command, African-American just quit a few weeks ago. He had the firing of the chairman of the Joint Chief of Staff, another African-American. If you could touch on that, it's a little bit unnerving.
No, it is. It is, because looking historically at the military was a place where African-Americans distinguished themselves and you know, rose to the highest ranks, probably most famously General Colin Powell. And the military, you know, after World War II, under President Truman, the military was desegregated. The military was one of the few places in American society, and probably in the 1960s, in the Vietnam War, where you would have blacks routinely ordering around whites. You know, a lot of the drill instructors were African American. The military has been a place for African American achievement, and so when you see this crew come in, you know, Trump and Hegseth, and you see under the banner of saying, "Well, we don't want a woke military, we don't want a DEI military," and you see the firing of distinguished, you know, African-American officers. I mean, this is something that I think is just entirely wrongheaded. It sends a dangerous message. It seems like, you know, it's almost like a return to a white supremacist military. And this would be a major step backwards in our country. Because, you know, I served in the military for 20 years. A lot of my friends were African-American, Filipino, Puerto Rican, what have you. I mean, these were the people around me. You know, I'm an average white guy from the working class. I worked with, you know, one of my bosses was a black female colonel. None of that stuff mattered, because I'm not saying the military is a perfect meritocracy, but it made a lot of strides over the last 50 years. And to see those strides being attacked by people like Hegseth is deeply disturbing.
Yeah. What do you make of something that I think is very disturbing, the militarization of our cities? National Guard, Trump calling up, federalizing the National Guard, sending in actual troops or attempting to. What do you think about that? And what do you think about it portends for elections next year in terms of the effect on the ballot box?
Right. Well, obviously, I disagree with it. The rhetoric that Trump uses is so dangerous when he talks about the enemy within, and he talks about the you know, the streets of America as a possible war zone. So now the militarization of the police, sadly, has been something that's been going on now for a couple of decades. You know, a lot of surplus military equipment has been given to police forces. I grew up with shows like One Adam 12. The image of police officers as, again, the citizens like us, you know, they just happen to carry a gun. They wear uniforms, but they don't wear, you know, nowadays our police tend to look more like soldiers with the helmets and riot gear and armored vests and all the rest. And then if you add to that the commitment of National Guard to the streets under the false premise that there's some kind of seditious activity going on. I mean, this creates, it creates an atmosphere that is anti-democratic, that is authoritarian, and much more like a dictatorship than a democracy.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's very concerning. I've been called hysterical in my concern about what's going to happen next year, but I don't think it's crazy to think that if Trump feels pressed, he, you know, could have the military and or the FBI seizing ballot boxes and, you know, all bets are off. I remember a friend of mine a few months before the 2020 election saying, you know, if Trump loses, you know, you better watch out. There's going to be violence. I went, oh, come on, man. That's a little far-fetched, and I was wrong, and he was right.
Part of the concern is that there's a sort of cult of Trump, right? His some of his followers are particularly fanatical. I guess my philosophy about politicians is that, you know, they're all supposed to be public servants, and they're supposed to be afraid of us. You know, we are these leaders. You know, they are supposed to be serving our ideals, setting the right example. And unfortunately, when you look at somebody like Trump, he is not in any sense a public servant. I do worry. You know, next year he'll be 80 years old. I think his mental and physical fitness for office is beginning to deteriorate, just as Joe Biden showed signs of deterioration as he hit his 80s. And what somebody unstable like Trump might do to keep his hold on power, as well as those who are surrounding Trump, like a man like Stephen Miller, it is concerning.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there's going to be inappropriate behavior if Supreme Court comes through and gives him the redistricting powers under the Voting Rights Act that he seeks. You know, it might not be necessary, but if it's close, who the blank knows what's going to happen. We just have a couple of minutes left. I think we'd be remiss by not talking about the death of Dick Cheney. If you could talk about that. I mean, kind of an ironic turn at the end of his life in terms of countering Trump, but a long legacy of questionable behavior before that.
Oh, most definitely. I think to be honest about Dick Cheney, he got us involved into the disastrous Iraq war in 2003, probably more than any other individual. He is responsible for that great tragedy and fiasco, and the thousands of American troops who died in Iraq, and then the hundreds of thousands of Iraqis who died, and the millions who were displaced because of that disastrous war. And of course, the other thing that Cheney is perhaps infamous for was the whole idea of going to what he called the dark side, you know, from Star Wars and all that. The idea that we had to embrace, we, America, a democracy, had to embrace torture and other illegalities so as to prevail. So, you know, Dick Cheney talked about this global war on terror, but he brought the terror to that war. And I think he'll be remembered for that reason.
Yeah, it's a highly questionable a legacy. I think, unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there. We need to get you back. Really appreciate all you're doing and joining us today. I've been Speaking with Bill Astori, a retired Air Force Lieutenant Colonel, history professor and writer. His blog on Substack is Bracing Views, and he's a senior fellow of the Eisenhower Media Network that includes Colonel Wilkerson, who we've had on this show before, former Chief of Staff for Colin Powell, who's of similar ilk to our guest today. Thank you so much for joining us. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you so much, Dave.
Take care. And on to our last guest, a little bit more uplifting, I think we can say. The Post-Classical Ensemble has an interesting program. Needless to say, coming up on November 19th at the Kennedy Center, The Pale Blue Dot, a musical voyage inspired by nature. The program explores the path from wild, pristine nature to a degraded natural world impacted by climate change to the rebirth of nature and cause for celebration, the full cycle. We're joined now by the ensemble's musical director, Angel Il Ordóñez. Thank you so much for being with us, sir.
David, it's always an incredible privilege and an honor to be with you and your audience.
It's great having you. So it sounds like a pretty ambitious program, but for folks that aren't familiar with the post-classical, if you could talk about that. This is not your normal classical music entity. There's always a panel discussion. There always seems to be some kind of an underlying politic to it in a wonderful, embracing kind of way. If you could talk about the group, the post-classical ensemble.
Absolutely, David. So in the end, what we have been aiming since our creation, already 22 years, is to change the experience of the concert, you know? So listening to music in a different way. And how do we do that? So what we do is to bring elements to the performance that will enhance precisely that experience. So in the end, we are telling a story. And we also operate like a museum. So I always love having people from other disciplines helping me creating a program. So in this case, we are talking about nature, and we have two extraordinary scientists, Dr. Enrique Sala and Christine Rechberger. Enrique is a marine biologist who has been working all over the world, convincing governments and making sure that the seas are protected. And he and Kristin have created this beautiful program that the structure is very simple. Is we live in harmony with nature, we destroy nature, and nature is so resilient that there is always a rebirth from nature. So we end with hope, and we have identified music that resonates with the three principles.
Yeah, I mean, you're having this concert in the midst. There's the whole climate change conference happening in the Amazon right now. I mean, it's pretty good timing, sir.
Absolutely. So we have chosen probably the most emblematic piece ever written that relates to the sea, which is Debussy's La Mer, the sea. So this is kind of the central piece of the program. And then for your listeners, you will be very interested in knowing that we are using for the destruction part the two extraordinary New Deal documentaries that we restored. You remember that we did that years ago, The Plow That Broke the Plains and the River. And we're going to show clips of those documentaries that talk about the Dust Bowl and the floodings of the Mississippi River. And so we're going to show clips of those documentaries in the 1930s. They have narration, and we are going to count with extraordinary actor Ed Giraud as the narrator. And we will play the music by Bill Thompson live with the images of the documentaries.
This is not your normal classical music ivory tower performance. I mean, it's very very grounded in what's going on in our greater world, and very serious, and yet also a celebration with absolutely gorgeous music. I mean, Debussy's one of my favorites. I mean, it's just so
extraordinary, extraordinary. And we have found, you know, we are a chamber orchestra, so we are not a full symphony. And I was able to find an extraordinary reduction for chamber orchestra of this piece by Debussy, which actually is going to be the U.S. premiere of that new arrangement for chamber orchestra. So we are very, very excited about that. And we are counting with the Children's Chorus of Washington for Enrique and Kristin, the guest curators, thought that it would be beautiful to include some excerpts of The Lord of the Rings that somehow they picked.
Oh, no kidding.
An ideal nature, you know, the images of the you know, you remembered some images of that. So we are going to do some excerpts of Lord of the Rings with the participation of the Children's Chorus. And then in the rebirth part, the chorus will participate again in the most beautiful flower duet by the Liebes from the opera Lakme. So I think it's going to be, we are going to cover many, many beautiful things in this program.
And for every ticket sold, a tree is going to get planted.
Isn't that beautiful? We are working with this beautiful organization, and they offered us. And I'm happy to tell you and your listeners that we are offering a 20% discount to the listeners of WPFW. So
thank you.
Just use this discount code, which is LAMER, LAMER 20. You use that discount, you go just to postclassical.com, and you will be able to go to buy tickets there, and you use that code. LAMER 20.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Of course.
I would be remiss. Your upcoming program in March looks just completely fascinating. You could just we just have a couple of minutes left, if you could touch on that.
Absolutely. Well, for that program, I'm working with another extraordinary guest curator, who is Drew Lichtenberg, who is the artistic producer of the Shakespeare Theater Company. And his expertise is precisely theater during the Weimar Republic, so the 1920s in Berlin, especially an extraordinary stage director who was a revolutionary, Edwin Piscator. And we are presenting a program on the music in the theater in Berlin, the 1920s. So unfortunately, the ascending of Nazism. And we are going to work on, you know, all this extraordinary artists and music that was happening, Kurt Weill and Friedrich Holländer and Hans Eisler. So this extraordinary period at the beginning of the 20th century that actually changed somehow the history of the world somehow.
Yeah, I mean, and it's timely. I mean, people were referring to the Weimar Republic, which was on the eve of the rise of Hitler, and its relation to what's happening in our country now. It's I think it's going to be an interesting musical evening and historically relevant, to say the least.
To say the least. I think we are also very excited about that. I mean, of course, as you know, this is the time of the beginning of the cabaret and you know, the influence, the French influence, the German influence, and Arnold Schoenberg writing, atonal music is an incredible period of creativity and excitement.
It's a very extraordinary Bertolt Brecht and
exactly.
Three Penny Opera. And
there you are.
It's just an extraordinary period with, as we're saying, a relevance to what's going on in this theater today. It's the program is Berlin in Lights, Cabaret Jazz and Radical Theater in Weimar, Germany, and that's, I guess, in March.
Exactly, this is March 11th.
And you can check it all out at the website for Post Classical Ensemble. And I've been speaking with the director of that ensemble, Angel Il Ordonez. Thank you so much for being with us, and thank you for all you're doing.
David, always a treat. Thank you so much.
Really appreciate it. And that's going to do it for our show. Thanks to our wonderful engineer for getting us through the last hour and coming up the fabulous, the incredible Lady Murr with Don't Forget the Blues. And check out David Whetstone's program tomorrow. I'm sure it will be fascinating as always at 11 o'clock. Stay safe. Have a good week. I'm Dave Rabin. Be well.
There'll be a grand celebration on Veterans Day, Tuesday, November 11th, at the African American Civil War Memorial, Vermont Avenue and 10th Street, Northwest Washington, D.C., from 11 a.m. until 4 p.m. We'll be reading the names aloud of the 209,145 black soldiers and their white officers that are written on the memorial walls. People are coming from all around the country to participate. The live reading will also be streamed nationwide via YouTube. If interested in joining us in person, you'll receive a list of names upon arrival and participants of all ages, including adults and children, are welcome. For more details, go to afroamcivilwar.org.
Good news, family. You can now take WPFW everywhere you go with our brand new WPFW radio app. Stream Jazz and Justice live, listen to archived shows, view the program schedule and playlist, donate, and more, all right from your phone. Download the WPFW radio app today from Apple App or Google Play Stores. WPFW in your pocket. Jazz and justice wherever you are.
Thank you, family, for standing with WPFW during our fall drive. Because of your support, we shared powerful moments. The No Kings protest, the 30th anniversary of the Million Man March, and a moving all-day broadcast on the struggles in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Listeners in the Congo downloaded our radio app, tuned in, and sent us messages of gratitude. Proof that your generosity connects people around the world. We came within $30,000 of our goal. If you are able, please help us close the gap and keep WPFW strong. Go to our website at wpfwfm.org, where you can donate or get our P.O. Box number of where to send checks. WPFW, Jazz and Justice, people-powered radio, connecting our communities globally, while building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
The Capital Area Food Bank is offering free food distribution for federal workers starting now until the government reopens. Federal employees and contractors will need to show a government work ID to receive food. Distribution times and sites are as follows. Tuesdays, 12 p.m. to 2 p.m. at No Limits Outreach Ministries, 7721 Barlow Road, Hyattsville, Maryland. Wednesdays, 10 a.m. to 11:30 a.m.
Hi, I'm Danny Glover, and you are tuned into WPFW Washington, your station for jazz and justice.
Even your cash is rubber.